Welcome to Dome Theory. I'm Bobby Manning. Another episode for you. We were off last week, 2 weeks ago. We discussed the end of the 76ers with Max Letterman, and wow, does that feel useless after what we saw the last 2 weeks in the sports world, in the world at large. If you follow my friend Obas, and you probably do, everybody wants to see the Obas rants, you might have heard the rumor that I drove Earth, Wind, and Fire September into the top 200 on Spotify, and that I'm Earth, Wind, and Fire's biggest fan. Now, yes, I do listen to Earth, Wind, and Fire. Two, I might have played a small role in that bump as September came around this week. And three, I greatly enjoyed Questlove's Earth, Wind, and Fire DJ set that he did about a month ago on his YouTube channel. And he's been doing amazing sets throughout quarantine. But I didn't do it. Look to some bigger fans because they drove September up into the top 200 as they have every year. Earth, Wind, and Fire is great. Our friend Obaso says that one night I played Earth, Wind, and Fire and it changed my life. And that is just not true. The story is, I brought this girl into my room sophomore year, 2 years ago now. 3 years ago? Yeah, we're talking 3 years ago now. Sophomore, Syracuse, we had our apartment on South. This girl came over to have a conversation, and it was a conversation, and Obas's room was next door. And I must have had some music going. Earth, Wind, and Fire came on. Maybe they were on the Abstract radio show that I used to listen to, Q-Tip's DJ set. And he thought they changed my life. And they didn't. But I still do enjoy them. I still think it's an amazing band. And I love, love, love that style of music. And that's an aside. We're into September now. Today on the show, we have Yusuf Abdul-Kadir. If you missed his viral video a month ago in July during the protests in Syracuse, you have to go check that out. Just completely undresses the mayor of Syracuse on police budgets, on allocation of resources and budgets in a city like Syracuse, a poor, medium-sized city, along with other large cities across America that face funding issues as well due to the amount of demand that's in these cities, where police budgets are the largest around the country. In the name of crime, in the name of safety. But what do you get out of that? And what inherently causes crime? We talked about all these things with him on here. This is a Syracuse show, so I was so thrilled to have him on. And the biggest reason I had him on is to talk about this wave of protests that we saw last week in the NBA, where teams walked off the court, pressed their organizations to do more, and ultimately returned to the court for the playoffs this week. So what will be the lasting impact of that? Do we look too much at athletes, at entertainers, to do these things to accomplish the progress we need to see socially in this country? I tend to think we do. Yusuf had a different take on it, and that's at the end of his segment here. First half hour, we talked to him. And then, if you've been following along the last month or so throughout the playoffs, I've been doing video breakdowns of these postseason games, talking over some film. The video version of the newest Watch the Breakdown is now up on my YouTube, Bobby Manning. You can go check that out with Sahal Abdi of Raptors Republic. He's going to join us in the second half of this show to talk about this Raptors team. The positive, carefree mindset of a champion. Their fans aren't freaking out. They're down 0-2 in the series. They're going to play Game 3 tonight as I record this. And they're not worried. If they come back, they come back. If they lose, they lose. They're just sky high after that championship that no one saw coming last preseason when the Raptors unbelievably upset the Warriors in the NBA Finals. Kawhi Leonard leaves. Expectations low this year. They have an incredible season. Now, hitting their first big wall of the year, of this bubble, certainly. And what the heck is going on with them? We're going to try to solve some of their issues and give Boston its appropriate props. They're 6-0 in these playoffs. 538 called them the champion favorites, odds on, after Milwaukee goes down 0-2. Celtics have a 35% chance, 538 says, of winning the championship in 2020. Wow. We are beginning to see this beginning of something special in Boston. So I'm Bobby Manning. This is Dome Theory. You can subscribe to us on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher. We're on all of those platforms and many more available on the front page of realbobmanning.com. Here is Yusuf Abdul Kadir.
What percent of the police live in the city?
5% or so.
5%, so 95% don't live in the city. Yes. So when you say that the vast majority of the percentage goes towards salaries, etc.,
yes,
fringe benefits, that means that they take their money on 81, go to outside the city, pay taxes in those communities that have some of the best schools while we have an underfunded school district.
$60 million up.
So I just want to put into context what we're talking about, because it's really easy to say, Mayor, and with all due respect, I like you, but that was a very politician answer.
What specifically?
The we will consider and we will look. What we're saying is we're not interested in considering and looking. What we're saying is actually there's 50 million, commit to 20 million cut.
There was no seller.
Yeah, you were saying the other night that you had to get those blocks in. And, you know, I'm in Boston. It's not too far from that.
Yes,
but
yep.
I always tell everybody the 4 years I spent in Syracuse made me appreciate Boston weather.
Are you from Boston originally?
Yep. I grew up north of Boston, a few years in Somerville. Now I'm up in Peabody on the North Shore. And everybody saw you in that viral clip at City Hall. That's why I want to have you on. You spoke so well on this issue that we're talking about in America right now with police departments and what needs to happen following, you know, the death of Ahmaud Arbery in particular. I think that's an interesting one. We'll get to that, of course, because that wasn't the police. That was, you know, vigilante killing of sorts.
Yeah.
Breonna Taylor and others at the hands of law enforcement, obviously. But we're talking here on Dome Theory today with Yusuf Abdul Kadir, adjunct professor at Syracuse University, American Civil Liberties Union in Syracuse, New York. I want to get in your background for the people that only know you from the clip. How long have you lived in Syracuse? You know, what's been the life that you've lived to get to the point where, you know, you're involved with the ACLU and speaking at City Hall and all these things?
Thank you very much for having me, Bobby. You know, as you said, my name is Yusuf, and you said it right. So I give you a check plus for
Thank
that.
You. I got to check that. It's a podcast.
Hey, listen, you know, you would be surprised. I had a, kind of as an aside, I had an interesting post that I shared the other day about names and how people like to call me everything but Yusuf. So thank you again for, you know, saying my name right. And I really appreciate this conversation. And I'm originally from the Bronx. And I went to middle school and high school in Spring Valley, New York, which is in Rockland County. And I came to Syracuse in 2004 as a freshman, and have been here the entirety of the time that I've been here is 16 years. But I've left to go back to New York and come back and then left to work at the UN and then came back actually almost exactly a little over 5 years ago. I came to become the director for the Central New York chapter of the NYCLU, which is the ACLU of New York. And it is in that context that I am here deeply engaged in trying to center and build the power of communities who are directly impacted on virtually every civil liberties and civil rights issue, whether it's excessive uses of force and law, from law enforcement, the kind of mischaracterization of justice in the criminal legal system, LGBTQ rights, environmental justice, and combating environmental racism. And it is in that context that we had an intervention in July of this year, where we discussed the kind of ways with which the ecosystems of policies and practices that include law enforcement both maintain racial caste and white supremacy, but also extract resources out of Black and brown communities in devastating, tragic ways.
Now, Syracuse is, and I, you know, I covered housing in Syracuse, I covered healthcare in Syracuse, a couple of things that go into this conversation. And it is such an interesting epicenter of these social conversations we have because of just the environment there. Historically Black city, you know, high minority, high refugee populations. We talk about the housing issues there, especially when it comes to lead paint, those kind of things. High crime, so a lot of, you know, police society interactions there, high police budget. And so, you know, we see you there in July lobbying the mayor, lobbying some of the leaders there. And this is a conversation that becomes more active in the wake of the killings that we've seen this year. But for you, did those speed up kind of the work that you do, you know, motivate you more to get in there and have those conversations? Or is that something you've been doing on a regular basis for a long time now in the city?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I want to say that we have a coalition called the People's Agenda for Policing. It's a multi kind of faceted organization that engages advocates and organizers and regular community people and people who are in policy to think critically about how do we transform issues around policing in Syracuse. We're not really dedicated to reform, because quite frankly, reform hasn't worked. You know, you can't reform away some of these issues. We actually have to radically transform the relationship between law enforcement and the community that they serve. And it's really key to understand that we have to abolish policing as we know it. The institution of policing emerged out of the maintenance of white supremacy, kind of continued through slave catching. And really, as we see in the 21st century, after the kind of ways with which it maintained Jim Crow and segregation in the 50s, 60s, it's been the major facilitator for the mass incarceration epidemic that we see today. And so it's not new that we've been doing this work. I think what made this moment or that moment unique or important was we actually, as a coalition, do everything by consensus. And we were pretty explicit that after several years of having kind of open dialogue with the administration, after trying to cross every T and dot every I and follow every part of the process, that wasn't working. So we needed to stage an intervention that reasserted the power imbalance that exists between those who are public servants and those that they serve. And that we wanted to be clear that the way with which we are addressing these issues are not going to be adequate, that business as usual is over, and that we have to chart a new course and we have to rise to this moment. I would be remiss if I didn't mention a slain person in Rochester, New York, Daniel Rell Prude, who in March, just before the death of George Floyd, was actually killed by Rochester police officers, a person who has a history of mental health issues, and whose body camera video, or the body camera video of his death, was recently released from a group called Free the People in Rochester. And it's another example of the countless people whose names we just don't know, that don't get the kind of viral moments, that don't get a person on standby or an onlooker to record it and share it on social media. And it's another example of the ways with which the entire system, I mean, these officers have been on the force since then, after George Floyd. They've not been fired. They've not been prosecuted. They've not been held accountable. The mayor knew, the chief of police knew, the district attorney knew, and it's just deeply concerning. So I wanted to take a moment to honor him and his family, and really all those that we don't get to hear of, and those that we hear of but whose voices kind of faint in the distance.
Certainly, in every city, we've heard the three notable ones in these cases, but there are names that go back decades and decades, especially before the time of smartphones as we have today, that, you know, weren't seen, that had the police's point of view taken as the gospel truth. I think that's something we on the journalism side are coming to grips with too, because you go to school for journalism and one of the tenets they teach you is to lean on the public officials, police included, for the information. And we look back now, when there were releases versus what actually happened in these videos that you see afterward, that there's discrepancies there, and it's worth questioning those things as well. So two things I wanted to focus on. One we'll get to later, the sports side of this. This is Dome Theory, sports and culture. Sports and these social issues have gone hand in hand, at least when it comes to national coverage. And we talk about bringing these issues to the forefront. I think it does something well in that, but also says something about the society in that we lean on these entertainment figures, you know, athletes, those kind of people to be the voices of this. So I want to have someone on like you who is doing the groundwork here, who has been trying to make these changes happen for, you know, close to a decade now, actually be the voice to this and talk about some of the solutions and, you know, things that need to change here. But, you know, people who saw you in that viral clip at City Hall in Syracuse talking to Mayor Walsh and bringing up one of a million different directions we could go in this, and one that hasn't been talked about a lot, maybe a little bit around New York City, but at least from stuff I've heard that I've read, this hasn't been talked about a lot, but you bring up as part of that long speech that you had there that the police in Syracuse, and I'd say in numerous large cities, Syracuse more of a medium city, but New York especially, don't live where they work. And there are various different issues with that. You hit on the money that goes to them and then leaves the city. You also just talk about familiarity between the people who you work for in the public and these police officers and the community. I mean, it's not their community at the end of the day that they're working in. So what prompted you to emphasize that in among all the different things we could talk about when it comes to the police?
Yeah, no, it was, you know, it's an important moment. I think because it puts into context what people mean when they talk about the way with which resources are extracted out of low-income communities in devastating, tragic ways, especially when those communities are Black and brown. It's not just that there is a warrior cop mentality with all the language, the technology, the mindset of war, right? Think about how we speak about it. The war on crime, the war on drugs, the war on terror. It's this mindset, the technology, the equipment that law enforcement use when they engage in these communities as if they're in a war zone, as if they're an occupying force and that these are occupying territories. And the types of tactics and strategies that they use are akin, if you will, to the ways with which the rules of engagement of war are. And that was one set that was important to raise. The second set that kind of has now gone viral and really sometimes appropriated properly, but oftentimes misappropriated, because we weren't necessarily speaking about or to the need for law enforcement to live in communities that they serve. Uh-huh. Of course, that's an important thing to happen. And of course, the law enforcement reflecting demographics of the community that they serve is also important, right? So we wanted to make clear that, you know, 95% of the law enforcement in Syracuse don't actually live in the city of Syracuse. Similar statistics exist in Rochester and in Buffalo and Utica and other parts of the state and around the country. And not only that 95% of the law enforcement didn't live in the city, but that they were racially not representative of the demographics of the city of Syracuse either. So 92%+ were white, with a city that has 50% minority population. And when you add the mentality, the language, and the types of implicit biases that kind of run amok, the idea that there's something about Black people, about brown people, that make them uniquely suspicious, that warrants kind of excessive behavior because they can't be civilized, that they're going to be animalistic, that they're going to be needing to be brought to heel, so to speak. That is brought to bear. So that's the second set. And the third set, which I think is the most important, is as we consider the fact that Syracuse has the highest concentration of poverty amongst Blacks and Latinos in the country, as we consider the fact that Onondaga County, which is the county whereby City of Syracuse sits in, is the ninth most segregated county in the United States. As we consider the hyper-segregation in schools, where Onondaga County, again, has the most segregated school boarders within the state of New York, and as we consider the fact that the way that we fund schools is through property taxes. And we do not have enough property taxes in Syracuse to be able to provide students with a sound, basic, not stellar, not dynamic, not excellent, not world-class, basic education as articulated by the New York State Court of Appeals, which is the highest court in the state. We are funneling resources on Interstate 81 in ways that facilitates for those monies that come out of taxpayer dollars to go on the highway and out of our community so that suburban communities, which are largely white, which are largely segregated, have all of the types of opportunities, all of the privileges, all of the resources, all of the services that we can't have in Syracuse. To be explicit, we had to use GoFundMe this summer to open up pools in Syracuse. But we had the money for armored vehicles, for tanks, for helicopters, 500 police officers across five or more police departments, for a peaceful protest. We had to put the city on a curfew for really nothing that was quite serious. And to be even further, as the city has to deal with the cuts that need to be made to the budget because of COVID, we're seeing that there are no real cuts being done to law enforcement. But you better believe that parks and recreation and youth services, the types of services that we know combat youth violence, that we know combat crime in our communities, the types of services and organizations that provide the kind of mentorship, we're cutting those organizations and those services, but we're not cutting the size, scope, and power of law enforcement. It makes us question, why do we prioritize solutions that don't work, that haven't been adequate, that are, and that we know have been centered around white supremacist, racial caste approaches, as opposed to the best practices that we know work? And I think it's in time for us to begin to ask that question and demand that we change and radically shift this relationship into a new direction.
Yeah.
That is what we were talking about.
And that scarcity mindset is what kills me about this conversation, because we in America do live with like the scarcity mindset at the government level, that you got to cut education, that you got to have balanced budgets at the local level, at the state level. So all of a sudden,
increase the defense budget every year.
Yeah. And that's nationally where you can run deficits and all that stuff. But again, we're not getting money kicked back to the states, back to communities when they're, you know, facing losses bigger than ever during this COVID time. And the discussion right now is defunding the police, moving money from police departments, which by and large are the most heavily funded function of a city, even though I don't think anyone would necessarily say that the most important thing in a city is the police. Mm-hmm. But you know, that's an aside, and try to get that funding toward education, you know, toward housing, toward these inputs of crime. You know, you're lacking in those areas. If you better fund those, you'd have lower crime in the first place. But there's sort of this mentality that you need to respond to crime, that you need to have a strong police force to be there in a city like Syracuse where crime is high, instead of trying to address those inputs of crime. Like it's backwards to me in a way.
It is. And I also want to be cautious, because I think what we tend to do in trying to make this argument is create a false narrative that there's something unique about poverty that makes people who are impoverished more criminalizing, mm-hmm. right? More likely to engage in criminal acts. When in fact, that's actually not what the issue is. We both went to Syracuse University. You know, I've gone to a fair frat party in my day, and I've seen excessive amount of drug use, every kind of drug at those parties. But I never saw law enforcement there. I never saw police there. I never saw DPS, which is Syracuse University's Department of Public Safety. I never really saw them there, but I did see them stopping black frat parties. I did see them stopping Latino frat parties. I did see them frequenting South Campus, which is a large black student population. So it's not that black and brown people or poor people are more likely to be engaged in criminal activity. It's that we actually deploy services and resources to black and brown communities, despite the fact that black people and white people commit crime at basically the same rates. And so I want to just be careful about not giving the argument that, you know, poverty breeds crime, because it's not necessarily the case. There's definitely a correlation between the two, but it's even when there is the same type of crime being done in a non-impoverished community, you still do not see law enforcement showing up to those areas. And I think that's really centered around the racial dynamic that exists and the views of who are criminal and who is dangerous. And I think that's really the key that needs to be taken away from this conversation.
Yep, the allocation. So protests, they've been going on. They continue to go on 3-4 months in. Early stages of it, you do start to see some commitments by cities to move budgets, to take solutions, to try to do things here. It's interesting, you know, we hear at the political level, especially nationally, a more moderate reform-minded message. Like I hear Joe Biden talking today about good cops, bad cops. And then, you know, in the streets, it's almost the entirely other side of people going as far as to say, get rid of policing in America, rebuild something else in its place. And that's the gap we kind of have between, you know, nationally, at least the moderate Democratic Party, and then, you know, more of a left-leaning side of it there. What steps is Syracuse specifically? You have people in the streets every day, months after months now. What have they taken to respond to that, to respond to the lobbying your groups have done at this point? And what have you seen in other cities out of this that you think move in the right direction?
We have a series of 9 demands, and we don't call them recommendations or asks or inquiries. We call them demands because we're saying this needs to happen. One of them has already happened by publicizing the police union contract. That was really important so that people can begin to understand how is it that law enforcement can skirt away from being held accountable. And often that's what's within the union contract. And our belief is that when people can see the contract, when that gets kind of put to the light of day, what winds up happening is we're able to see, wait a second, why is it that, you know, we allow for these types of behaviors? Why isn't sexual assault considered a fireable offense? That seems to be something that should be pretty obvious. When an officer engages in misconduct, particularly sexual assault or rape, as has been the case in the city of Syracuse, that officer should be fired and prosecuted. Except in the case of Syracuse, that officer will not only stay on the force, but could potentially get promoted. We talked about changing the use of force policy. And for those who don't know the use of force policy, it's basically a policy that determines the ways with which law enforcement are able to use different types of force, whether that's tasers, whether that's chokeholds, or other types of escalations, lethal force as well. And it's a kind of rules of engagement for law enforcement. And Syracuse's mayor wanted to present the idea that other communities around the country are doing these things that we've already done in Syracuse, and tried to paint himself and Syracuse as a national leader, but forgot to share the detail that the only reason why Syracuse addressed the issues around chokeholds is because we at the NYCLU had to sue them. And it wasn't an easy lawsuit. You know, his corporation counsel fought so that a 15-year-old couldn't get justice. And I want to be clear that this was a 15-year-old. The day prior, he was 14. This was his 15th birthday. A young man who was stopping a fight was put in a chokehold by a police officer whose duty is to protect and serve, but put him in a chokehold to the point that he fell to the ground, you know, almost lost consciousness, had a gash from the right part of his cheek to the bottom left part of his cheek. And in that encounter, that young man didn't say, I want $1 million settlement. He didn't say, I want, you know, the officer to be fired. He said, I don't want anyone to ever experience this again. And even in that, the city's lawyers, the Office of Corporation Counsel, fought for that change to happen. So Mayor Walsh wants to present the idea that he's this grand reformer, but doesn't give you the idea that actually you're not reforming because you decided to on your own. In fact, when we have pushed you, you still haven't done the thing that you committed to, which is what that 3-hour and 40-minute intervention was about. Because we sat for months, in fact, for 2 years, advising and trying to get the administration and trying to work with them to change. We provided them an 18-page document, which analyzed their use of force policy, which compared it to other jurisdictions across the country, which took recommendations from the International Association of Chiefs of Police. And he didn't take those recommendations. And so I think it's important to put in the context that we had a series of nine mans, and while we haven't gotten all of them done, we're demanding that they be done. To date, we have two of them done, and it's in a few weeks, the third demand, which is a piece of legislation around the Right to Know Act, would be implemented, which is a law that deals with citizen police encounters. And we're going to continue to make sure that the remaining six demands are met. And we're going to continue to amp pressure in every sort of way possible and continue to escalate to make sure that that happens.
You mentioned the legal side, and that's something the Civil Liberties Union is always going to be involved in there. And I find it interesting, we're having a discussion about police in this country. We're also having a discussion about mail in the country. And I listened to the fundamentals of this Postal Service conversation, and they have a union, but the only reason they can have a union is because they're a semi-independent government entity that has to prove its worth, that has to fund itself, that has to, you know, generate the money to actually pay out to its employees and all that stuff. But when we talk about police, one of the most powerful unions in the country, you discussed the union contract. We think of some of the legal shoe-ins that they have, like qualified immunity, all these different things. FOIA, I think they're exempt from FOIA too in many cases. The amount of shoe-in they have is unbelievable. And compared to other unions, compared to other public institutions, they just have so much more legal power when it comes to the union, government contract, and interaction.
I think the context with which you put your question is really important, right? Because they do have a tremendous amount of power. And, you know, we believe in collective bargaining. We believe in people's right to organize. We believe in unions. I mean, we are the American Civil Liberties Union. So we believe in those principles and those ideals. I think the challenge and the struggle that we find ourselves in is that the way with which law enforcement engages is so grossly problematic. That they use their power to not allow the public's benefit to be fulfilled. And so to give a specific example beyond union contracts, when an officer engages in misconduct, oftentimes, until recently, you would not be able to get access to their personnel records to show that this officer has not just one incident, but a history, a pattern of practice of engaging in excessive uses of force, as was the case with the officer who killed Eric Garner, Officer Pantaleo. You know, that officer had a history of excessive force, and not just excessive force in the broader terms, a history of a relationship with this individual, Eric Garner. We find the same thing with Officer Gavin, who was the officer that killed George Floyd. Again, the same kind of excessive force history. We find that there are these repeated offenders. And in the city of Syracuse, we have an oversight body called the Citizens Review Board, which has quasi-independent authority to be able to engage in investigations, come up with a series of findings, and make recommendations for discipline. The police department has stymied any ability for real accountability to happen by not sharing what is the legislative requirement that they have on the ordinance that institutes the Citizens Review Board to share information with the CRB when they are doing an investigation, to the point that they waited in many instances beyond 18 months, which is the legal time frame for an officer to be disciplined. So even if the CRB sustains a finding, they can never hold the officer accountable because it's outside of the window. And so you see a series of practices and structures and systems that are established in such a way that absolve law enforcement from being able to be held accountable. And honestly, that's not fair. It's not fair that we as taxpayers, again, in the city of Syracuse, but as well as many other cities around the country, have to pay millions of dollars in lawsuits when officers engage in misconduct, but the officer has no accountability for that behavior, if they're ever disciplined. And in the case of Syracuse, what we've actually seen happen is that when an officer engages in misconduct, and when that misconduct has resulted in the death of an individual, we've seen officers get awarded. And so it's a tragedy and a travesty It's a mischaracterization of justice. And while we believe in the idea and the ideals of collective bargaining rights and unions, there's something specific and unique about the ways with which the police unions operate that set them apart from other unions that I think needs to be examined a bit further.
Absolutely. And you brought up something definitely important and early in the interview, that these interactions fall on minority populations in particular because of that allocation issue. But I think what anybody can at least empathize at the most minimal level in this is the idea of wanting to get the most out of your public institutions, and the idea of accountability, and this idea that everybody loves the Constitution. We have all these different Bill of Rights to protect against this overreach of government power that, you know, most typically happens through the police. They're the government arm that's interacting with the people on a day-to-day basis. So I think if you can't empathize on any level with this, you should at least be able to look at it through that angle and feel for it. But, you know, this is what we're seeing right now with the NBA, some of these sports leagues. The WNBA, I think, doesn't get enough credit in this. I mean, they have been extremely vocal going back for years before this. And I heard some of their players talking while the NBA players were protesting, and they're discussing, you know, the highest paid player in the WNBA makes just under $200,000 a year. So they're saying, if we have to step away from this, if we have to lose our contract for this protest, we might have to be ready to go do something else. And
actually, many of them have. Right?
Yeah, Maya Moore.
Exactly. And I think I'm happy that you started with the WNBA, because oftentimes Black women are ignored and are kind of not recognized. I mean, if you look at the ways with which, I don't want to do tragedy Olympics, but if you look at the ways with which there's been a significant amount of tension on the deaths of Black men, but very little justice, if justice at all, for Breonna Taylor. The fact that we've learned in the news that the district attorney is actually trying to get her ex-boyfriend to claim that she was engaged in criminal activity just to justify their extrajudicial killing of her. I mean, it's amazingly atrocious.
Can you get into a little bit? Can you get into that Breonna Taylor case a little bit? Because we're 171 days out, no arrests, no movement at all, and I think that confuses some people. Like, why is that?
It is disgusting, and this is why I do not call it the criminal justice system. Because if you think about her case, there's nothing just about this, and it's also why we talk about these issues as an ecosystem. Because what is often underreported is that the neighborhood that she lived in was a neighborhood that was becoming gentrified. And the more that it was becoming gentrified, the increasing presence that law enforcement was needed to keep the new incoming community members feeling safe. And it's so important because we see this pattern around the country. We see it in Syracuse, right? So Syracuse is going through a shift. Downtown Syracuse has gone through a rebirth and has been going through a renaissance for the last 10 years or so, where apartments are like $3,000 a month, where the occupancy is like almost 100%. It's like 99%, where the median income is like $100,000. If you go a few blocks away, the median income is like $20,000. And what we're seeing is as there's an expansion in downtown Syracuse, as it becomes gentrified, the presence of surveillance cameras and the presence of police officers and the presence of police stations in those areas are increasing. And you saw the same thing in the case of Breonna Taylor. And so as law enforcement comes into her home, as she is sleeping, a first responder, a woman who is aspiring to just be a successful human being, the kind of dreams that we all dream of, to the dreams of being a mother, perhaps, the dreams of being a successful, self-fulfilling, self-sustaining woman, the dreams of being loved and married, the dreams of being able to start a family of her own, the dreams of being a being, were snuffed away from her for sleeping in her bed through a no-knock warrant, where the officers barge into the home, shot up dozens of bullets that wound up shooting her. Her boyfriend at the time, not knowing what's going on, because no one announced that they were there, no one announced they had a warrant, no one announced that they were law enforcement, and was getting fire and was firing back on them, was arrested. Breonna winds up dead. Innocent, killed, no justice for her whatsoever. And not even her memory is being honored in the way that it should be. Not a recognition of the fact that his life is gone. And it's completely untenable. And so it's not the first instance of a Black woman whose life has been snuffed away. You know, you can be Black and sleeping, you can be Black and walking, you can be Black and jogging, you can be Black and driving, you can be Black and in a suit, you can be Black and a professional, you can be Black and homeless. The greatest indicator is the fact that you are Black. And that's what ties all these cases together. And so it's with a heavy heart that we see there has been no justice for Breonna Taylor. The news cycle has shifted to other issues. The trends have kind of let her story get, you know, kind of further and further wiped out into the annals of Twitterverse. And we see, but not for the fact of the WNBA and others who continue to uplift her name and to say her name and recognize her, that we would have lost attention. So I think it's important to uplift the WNBA and women of the WNBA for making sure that we don't lose her story.
Yeah, and I wonder what the impact of that NBA protest, the WNBA, pushing the conversation around that. I find it so interesting. I'm in the sports world, so I cover these things, and it seems like so much of society looks to the entertainers, to the athletes, to these people at high levels of attention to talk about these things, to do something about these things. And I found it interesting in the protests on the NBA side, Fred VanVleet saying that these organizations, which are multi-billion dollar organizations, could use their pull in the communities, could use their money in the communities they're in, especially in Wisconsin when we talk about Jacob Blake, the pressure change here. But the protest ends after a week, didn't get any direct commitments of that kind, at least that were out there publicly. And so to go back to this, so there's an awareness to this that I think is positive, but do we put too much on athletes, on entertainers, on, you know, celebrities in general on these things, especially you as someone who, you know, is doing the work on the ground, or is it just useful to have that message out there anyway?
I think it's tremendously important that their activism occurred in the moment that it did. Mm-hmm. Not everyone can be marching in the streets every day. Not everyone can be deeply involved in policy analysis. Not everyone can be litigators and suing in court. Not everyone can be giving a speech or having a discussion on a podcast. People can do what they can do in their faculties and their capacities and with the power that they have. And with the power that they have, they did bring attention to this issue. Perhaps there could have been more change that could have happened. Perhaps there's more that needed to go on. But they did something important and historic. And I don't want to undervalue what that is and what's to say that their work is done.
Yep.
You know, the shift in conversation has occurred. And it wasn't just WNBA and NBA. It was Major League Soccer. It was Major League Baseball. It was the most historic sports event in the sense of social justice consciousness, tremendous power. And I think what they were doing in taking the strike is saying, if you don't begin to shift things, you're going to see that we're going to walk away. And now the ball is in the court, so to speak, of the owners. What are the owners going to do? Because it's their obligation as well. It's not just on the Black bodies to elevate these issues. What are white people going to do in positions of power? What are others in positions of power and authority going to do to speak out about injustice? You know, to say that this is not okay and to do something about it. And so I want to acknowledge that there was a tremendous import and value add. You know, it did continue to give energy to the issue and help to continue to sustain the momentum. And a point that was really essential and necessary. And I don't want to undervalue that. I think it's really tremendous and important. There's obviously more work that can be done. Mm-hmm. And I hope that they do continue. And if they want to talk, we can figure out some things together. But I really do think that it was an important contribution to history and to this moment that we find ourselves in today.
For certain. Yusuf Abdul-Kadir doing the work on the ground, dropping the knowledge here. If people want to help out the things you do, the things people are doing on a day-to-day basis to improve these things, to make the adjustments that are needed, to win these battles, what can everyday people do?
there's a few places I would recommend people go to. I, you know, would be remiss if I didn't mention the NYCLU. So please go to nyclu.org and support our work. I would be remiss if I didn't mention Black Freedom Project, which is doing so much work around these issues, Black Freedom Movement rather, that is doing so much work around these issues, and really is engaged, around addressing the challenges that we're seeing in our communities. If you're considering about Syracuse, there's the Syracuse chapter of the National Action Network that is doing tremendous work. And the group who is in Syracuse working on the issues around police reform is SPARC, Syracuse Police Accountability and Reform Coalition. And our website is SPARC, SPARC315.org. Folks, please go to your local officials, to your state officials, to your federal officials and demand change. They work for us. You know, they are public servants. And if, as we say in the organizing world, what do we want? Justice. When do we want it? Now. If we don't get it, shut it down. And I think it's incumbent upon us to realize that they really should be working on behalf of our interests and our concerns. And if we don't get it, we've got to shut it down.
Thanks, Yusuf. And if you want to keep following him, you can find him on Twitter at Yusuf, Y-U-S-U-F-A-Q. Thanks for being here on Dome Theory, man. Always good. This podcast originated in Syracuse, so to connect with people in Syracuse, there's nothing better. We'll talk to you soon, man.
Take care.
We welcome Sahal Abdi, as promised, second half of Dome Theory. For those of you watching, you'll be able to check this out on my YouTube channel as well. Watch the breakdown. This is fitting, Sahal, because when I thought I'd watch the breakdown, I did one episode as Film Hour, which was just boring. So I was like, you know, what could I do for a name here? And I'm going through my music that day, and it was Drake's the song there. The one with the Lauryn Hill sample. I can't even think of the name now.
With the Lauryn Hill sample.
Yeah, I just had it up. Now I got to look it up because I can't forget the name of the song.
No, you can
Nice for What. One of my top three favorite Drake songs. And right in the middle, there's a cut, Watch the Breakdown. So I'm like, there we go. Drake, basketball, perfect. So we're doing this with a guest for the first time. Sahal writes for Raptors Republic, been covering the team since 2017. And that's about the same time that we've been waiting to get this series. Year in and year out, the DeMar DeRozan years, the Isaiah Thomas years, getting PJ Tucker in there. That still kills me that the Raptors got Tucker that year and the Celtics didn't. And things played out the way they did because of LeBron pretty much on both sides. But now LeBron's out west. We got our series, and it has not gone well so far. So what have you made of this season? What have you made of this team? What's been the sentiment since they won the championship on the Raptors side?
I think there's been a lot of confidence for Toronto. There's been, and rightfully so. I mean, a lot of pundits were kind of expecting Toronto coming off of losing a top five, I'd say, consensus player in Kawhi Leonard, a guy known as a bona fide superstar across the league. Whenever you lose that guy, I mean, generally you would think that this team's going to fall off the wagon. But when you have a guy like Kyle Lowry, who's a six-time All-Star, a guy like Pascal Siakam, who's a budding star, Fred VanVleet, and then you have a bunch of very, very good role players around them, a guy like Marc Gasol, who I wouldn't even really consider a role player. He's a very good five for the Raptors. He fits in for exactly what they want to do. But I think the sentiment coming into the season was that, maybe we might not win a championship this season. Let's make this run and let's make it enjoyable while we do it. And I think Toronto for sure has made this run enjoyable. They're in the second round now with Boston. They swept the Brooklyn Nets pretty easily. A team obviously without Kyrie Irving, without Kevin Durant. That was more of the expectation for Toronto to kind of just get rid of Brooklyn really quickly and then move on to what we would assume was Boston, what is now Boston. But going into this series, I mean, I don't want to get into it too quickly, but I think going into this series, a lot of Raptors fans were worried. This is a team that's beaten them three times before the playoffs even began. A team that matches up, I personally think matches up better than any team in the NBA, including the Milwaukee Bucks. This is a team that I generally thought that if Gordon Hayward was healthy, you know, that hypothetical was there, that the Celtics are should be at least be the favorite team in this series. And I had the Celtics in seven if Gordon Hayward was healthy. So this is an exciting series. I'm really excited to get into it and get into some clips and get into what we think is probably one of the better series so far in the NBA playoffs.
Well, on my end, it's respect. And we do these post-game shows over at CLNS Media. We do a lot of videos going into the series since the Celtics swept the 76ers, had a little bit of time to look ahead to this one. And the Raptors fans are active. And this is a long-term thing because they're disrespected champions first and foremost. But then you have about a quarter century, 25 years now or so, where they haven't gotten the national TV games. They don't fall within the United States, so you have all those implications. The league doesn't have as much of incentive to sell this team, yada, 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 even though they've been great over the years. So this fan base comes out hard, and we have all our different opinions about this series coming in, and no matter what, I was saying Raptors in seven before this one. You know, the rest of my crew there said Celtics, and they still just come at you no matter what you say, like 100 comments deep. YouTube's the place where they go, I guess, to get out, get down to the team. And there's respect. I mean, I've been up to Toronto. The crowd that you have there is insane. The gathering outside Jurassic Park, whatever it is phenomenal. I was there during that Bucks-Raptors series last year. The game two where they went down 0-2 as they did in this series. It didn't feel great that night. And then, of course, they run off, you know, probably six of the next eight and win the championship. So respect for me coming in, the fast break, the way they bounce back, giving all these veterans another chance to do their thing, even though they lose Kawhi. I love what they did. But now here we are 2-0 in the series. And the fact that they extended Lowry, that they have these two big men, Ibaka and Marc Gasol, who are going to be free agents. Van Vliet's a free agent. This is where it does get a little nerve-wracking because – you know, you win 57 games, you expect to go a little further than this. And this matchup, as you said, is a big issue, it looks like. And the team itself looks so flat. Like Gasol, just not himself. All these different things. Van Vliet's 5 for whatever from 3, 23. Like things, they don't look like the same team. They've been killing everybody else. They have like a plus 10 differential against everybody else. And then this Boston matchup, they've been getting beat up for 2 games, and then they blow in the fourth quarter of this game.
Yeah, I mean, everything you said was the truth. I mean, Boston's been a team that they've struggled with, and credit to Boston. I mean, they have a team that matches up extremely well with Toronto. You have Jason Tatum, you have Jaylen Brown, you have Daniel Theis, who I think Theis has been one of the most impressive players so far in this series. Obviously, not counting a guy like
I love that guy.
I love him as well. I love him as well. I'm really happy I got a chance to watch him as well, learn more about his game. He's like the quintessential five man in the NBA. He's a very good rim defender. He can shoot from the outside. He can do almost everything Marc Gasol can, and what the Raptors have been expecting from Marc Gasol but haven't really gotten to. But I'm sure we'll get into Marc Gasol as well. You know, Boston's been a team that the Raptors have struggled with. Milwaukee is a team that, you know, Raptors fans, you said it, like Raptors fan base is extremely active on social media. They are. And we've been focused a lot on Milwaukee. I think Raptors fans have made a mistake in kind of overlooking Boston throughout the season. It was always Milwaukee, the fascination, you know, with Giannis's upcoming free agency in 2021. No one's really, you know, given that respect, I think, that Boston really deserves. And I think now Raptors fans are starting to realize, hey, this team is for real, and this team really has a chance to run away with this series now.
Well, for everybody listening on the podcast side, you can go over to my YouTube channel, Bobby Manning, and get the video version of this where we'll be diving into some of these plays that have defined these first 2 games here on Watch the Breakdown. If you're listening over on Dome Theory, I want to give Sahal a minute here. And here I got into the Raptors, got into writing, all that stuff that he's doing over there at Raptors Republic.
Yeah, Raptors Republic, it's very exciting. So 2017, I'm not sure if you're familiar with Blake Murphy, but Blake Murphy kind of hit me up. I was writing at a smaller blog, Raptors Rapture, before that. 2017 is when Raptors Republic kind of reached out to me and were kind of interested in just bringing me along. And at that moment, you know, for me, Raptors Republic or just writing in general wasn't really something that I was pursuing. It was more of a hobby for me. But writing, you know, all through high school is something that I always wanted to do. It was something that when you put sports and writing together, it's two of probably my favorite things to do. So when I got that opportunity from Raptors Republic, I definitely ran with it. They have an extremely, extremely engaging fan base, you know, hundreds of comments on each of the articles. And we have a very good team as well, a team that I'm really proud to be a part of. So I can't really, you know, complain with the situation that I'm in with Raptors Republic. And I appreciate, obviously, everybody that's supporting me thus far on my journey.
Well, let's do this. Sahal Abdi, Bobby Manning, getting into this on Watch the Breakdown. And the big play that Nick Nurse was talking about out of game two. Final 30 seconds, Pascal Siakam's got the ball. This is his opportunity. They've been waiting for him to make the big play to steal a game from the Boston in this one. Didn't have the best game one. Improved to some degree in game two. And then here, he's on the roll. He's getting to the basket here against Marcus Smart on the switch. And this is the game. This is the play that ultimately defined the game. And Toronto got a second chance off of it because Smart breaks up the play here. They go to a review. They say they stepped out of bounds on the steal. And Marcus Smart, so good in this one. On the switches, they're fine with him taking Siakam there. He did it in the post. He did it on the drive. And this play here, Nick Nurse hated it. He wanted a foul call here. I don't see it. It's tough on the angle I have right here. But I don't know. They got a second chance off of this anyway, I say. What do you see on this one?
Yeah, I mean, it's arguable. As a Raptors fan, of course, Raptors fans are gonna say, hey, he was fouled, and I get it. I'd understand that view. But I'd also understand if you're a Celtics fan, you say, hey, like, it's late in the game. That's not really going to get called. If you, if you've ever played basketball before and you're driving in, you have the two hands on the ball, and you kind of get slapped, and your hand gets slapped first, and then it's the ball. I mean, like, it's an iffy call for referees. It's an iffy call, even in pickup basketball. So, but getting to Marcus Smart, I mean, wow, what a player. I mean, this guy is a guard who has a never say die attitude, a guy that when you're on the opposing team, you absolutely hate him because of the intensity, and he can really dictate pace in a game. And Marcus Smart's the type of guy that, he switches onto a guy like Siakam, who probably has 5-6 inches on him. And he loves it. I mean, he's unfazed. He loves it. You could see he kind of takes it as a challenge. And when Siakam drives in on him, you saw what happens. Marcus Smart timed it perfectly, got the little steal. He did step out of bounds, so Raptors did get another chance. But, I mean, what a series Marcus Smart has been having. We haven't really even talked about his shooting yet. His shooting has been completely out of it. I mean, the 76ers, I think I read a stat. He was 2-for-18 from three, which is obviously not Marcus Smart level. But what he's doing in this series is absolutely incredible in terms of his shooting and then obviously in terms of his playmaking and his defensive ability.
Yeah, he's so handsy. And we'll get to his shooting. And the fact that Boston even has him at this point is amazing. I'm going to save that for when we get to those three-point barrage that he threw out there in the fourth quarter. So Siakam, I want to stick on him. So that was one of the misses in the fourth quarter that he had. He was 0-3 in this, 2 points in the fourth quarter. Better game. Nick Nurse said he wants to stick with those post-ups. I think they feel, as you said, the size advantage that they can beat Brown in there, who's about 6'5", 6'6". They can definitely beat Smart in there because he's 6'4". If you get a good look over him, you can shoot over him. And still, he has struggled in these playoffs. He's down under 40% shooting. His three-point stroke's about 24%. And this is a guy who they re-signed for the future, who became the face of the team for the future at least, if it's not Kyle Lowry right now. And I look at him in this fourth quarter, just doesn't have the touch early in the game on Jaylen Brown, as we see here, just off inside on a post-up or, you know, drive and post-up opportunity close to the basket. And I see these plays. He's not able to get deep in the post. He's a little out. He's about 12, 10 feet from the basket, and it's tough to hit a hook shot from there.
Yeah, Pascal Siakam's struggles thus far in the series are well documented. This is a guy that we mentioned earlier that Kawhi Leonard left his team in the offseason, went to the Los Angeles Clippers. Pascal Siakam was the guy who was kind of supposed to take the step up, and he did in the regular season. But I think in the playoffs thus far, he's had his struggles. And some of it you could say, I think, is due to some of the matchup problems that the Boston Celtics present for him. They have probably 3, 4, possibly 5 guys that can switch on Siakam and give him a little bit of trouble. He's coming off of a series in Brooklyn where he wasn't really given that trouble. He had guys like Timothy Luwewu-Cabarrot who would be guarding, who is a long defender, but you know, thin guy who Siakam can really just shoulder into and get a bucket when he needs to. But when a guy like Jason Tatum switches onto you, or a Jaylen Brown, or even a Marcus Smart, I mean, we mentioned the size advantage he has in Marcus Smart, and you look at it as a Raptors fan or as a Raptors writer, and you say, okay, Pascal should be able to score here. But Marcus is an elite defender. He's one of the best defenders in the league, perimeter and I think low post for a guard. It reminds me a lot of Kyle Lowry. Those are two very good guards in the low post defensively. But I think Siakam, he for this series to be competitive and for the Raptors to eventually, you know, tie this series, I know they want to get game three and definitely game four. I think Siakam's definitely going to have to take a step up and prove that, hey, we need a bucket. You need to go get us a bucket, you know?
You see the gap between Jason Tatum and him here too. Siakam, yeah. he's got to grow more to be a number one option on the team, and maybe he isn't. Maybe they do need to eventually go out there and get a number one who can create for him and just bring the team back up to that championship level. Tatum, I mean, I saw 538 today put the Celtics statistically as the best odds on favorite to win the NBA Finals based on where they are, where others are. And Tatum's a big reason. He kills Philadelphia. He absolutely demolishes Toronto in that first game and does it again here while everyone around him struggling. And this play here defined the game after all those smart threes, about 6 minutes left, Toronto's within three. And Siakam a little bit too low on that pull-up jumper there. I think Kemba pulled him over the right here. And Toronto, for all the looks they give you defensively, they haven't been able to bother Tatum. Now, Tatum, way in this game, almost blew it with the technical foul there. He ends up making up for it with some of the buckets beforehand and the passing in this fourth quarter. But, you know, they got to do a better job on him, make it more difficult for him. The fourth quarter wasn't amazing, 1-for-4. That three was the only bucket he had with 5 points. But I even go back to this one in the first quarter early in this game. Robert Williams setting him up well with the screen. A little bit of a moving screen here, but, you know, they let you fly with that. And, you know, Tatum's just free for jump ups while Marc Gasol and some of the other guys are sitting back. What do you do to contain him?
It's so tough with a guy like Jason Tatum. His offensive arsenal is massive. I mean, this is a guy that was, you know, practicing and doing a lot of training with the late Kobe Bryant. Mm-hmm. One of the guys probably has the best offensive arsenal, you could argue, in the league's history. And you see a lot of that stuff in Jason Tatum. I mean, his pull-up jumper is, you know, up there with some of the best in the league. And the thing that really, you know, kind of irks you as a Toronto Raptors defender with Jason Tatum is that he's one of the very few guys in the NBA that you think you have him, and you think, okay, you know, we defended the screen perfectly, and Jason Tatum just rises over you on a mid-range jump shot, and you're like, there's no way he's hitting this, and he hits it, and then he'll hit it again in the next possession. And Jason's one of those guys that you can really guard him perfectly, and there's sometimes just no way to really contain him. I think with the Raptors, they have been putting Kyle Lowry on him for the majority of the regular season, and then you see it obviously in the playoffs as well, and Jason Tatum is kind of cross-matching with him as well, guarding Kyle Lowry on the other end. But I think it's going to come down to team defense. I think with a guy like Serge Ibaka, who Jason Tatum, I feel, is really abusing on screens, Serge Ibaka's been, his defensive focus, I think, hasn't really been there. The level that the Raptors have been wanting. I think Marc Gasol kind of struggled in game one. The whole team really struggled in game one, but Marc Gasol kind of came back defensively in game two. It was a lot of tough shots with Kemba Walker kind of driving into the paint, starting off the game 2-for-14. But Jason Tatum is one of those very few guys that, I mean, I watch this guy and I'm in complete awe of his offensive game, complete awe.
You see him evolving as a passer in this one, too. And I think that's what frees him up, too. He's a threat to throw that skip pass. And this is what set Marcus Smart up for that explosion at the beginning of the fourth. And this is probably the best Marcus Smart game I've ever seen. I've been covering his whole career in Boston. Saw him in college at Oklahoma State. Like, his emergence as an X factor who can become a star on any given night like he did here. Fred VanVleet's on him to start this fourth. I heard even Zach Lowe talking about maybe hiding Gasol on him. And I said coming into the series, you're missing Hayward, who's reliable in the spot we saw Smart go off here. But Smart has nights where he can just go crazy from that same position. So I'm like, if Smart can increase his three-point shooting here, they won't feel that Hayward lost as much. I didn't expect 11 three-pointers through two games, but Tatum sets him up so well here. And what I find so interesting, the first one we're showing here, Grant Williams sets it up on an offensive rebound. Later, Grant kicks it to him from the corner. But on the second one, Smart sets the screen and kind of pops out to that right wing. And Toronto's defense is just sitting there and laying off him and saying, like, do we put extra attention? How do you put so much extra attention on this guy when there's all these other scorers out there?
And that's the tough thing with Boston. I mean, especially with their addition of Kemba Walker, you can have a few possessions where you guard a guy like Jason Tatum or Jaylen Brown to perfection. And then you have a guy like Kemba Walker, who is probably one of the better fourth quarter players in this league. There's a reason people call him Cardiac Kemba. I mean, he started the game off 2-for-14, and then he shot the lights out in the fourth quarter. He literally said, hey, you guys are going to follow me. And this is a guy who doesn't really have playoff experience. He was in Charlotte. I believe maybe they made the playoffs 1 year.
Yep, against the Heat.
Yeah, it was against the Heat. And so this is a guy that you're expecting, I mean, to not necessarily blow you out of the water in the playoffs, Kemba Walker. He doesn't have experience. Like a guy like Jason Tatum has. Jason Tatum has been in the playoffs, I'm sure, every year he's been in the league. So the tough thing with Boston is there's so many options. And then it's like, okay, you have Jason Tatum, you have Jaylen Brown, you have Kemba Walker, and then you have Marcus Smart just shooting out of his mind. You have role players like Robert Williams, you know, contributing on offense and defense. You have a guy like Daniel Theis, who it's like, okay, we finally got everyone under control. Oh, Daniel Theis is in the corner. Three, bang. You know? But, yeah, I mean, with the rap.
This is what we're going to see on all this tape, too. Just everybody coming through on Boston's end, and Toronto's like, who can step up for us in this? Kemba was interesting. I'm glad you bring him up. He was my bonus guy for this episode, and I don't know what happened to him in game two here. He was so slow starting off. It was probably the worst half I've seen him play in a Celtics uniform this year. Starts 0-8, 2-14 eventually. And I'm showing this play, too, right before halftime where like he got whacked at the beginning and then he reacted late to it. Him and Rob are kind of juggling the ball back and forth. And it's a hesitation from Kemba that I haven't seen from him all postseason, all regular season. It looked like Lowry and others made him uncomfortable out there. He did bang his knee up in game one. And we're looking at it and we're like, uh-oh, is this going to be another injury that the Celtics have to deal with alongside Hayward? And then he comes up big in the fourth quarter with that step back on Ibaka, is in full position to get that shot off. Absolutely filthy. He's had a few of those to win games in these playoffs against Philly too. Like, I don't know. It was weird to see him struggle at the beginning of this, and then even weirder after that to see him look like himself in the fourth quarter and basically win this game.
Yeah, Kemba Walker, ultra confidence. That describes his game. I mean, a lot of stars, you start off the game 2-for-14 and you shrink. You don't want the ball anymore. You give it to guys like Jason Tatum. You give it to guys like Jaylen Brown. Even Marcus Smart, you say, hey, you guys handle it. I'm not really having a great game. Kemba Walker's not that guy. Kemba Walker was, you know, that step back, it gave me UConn, University of Connecticut, you know, flashbacks.
Yeah, Ibaka flying, like, I don't know who was on the other end of that one at UConn. Wanamaker, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, goodness gracious, Madison Square Garden. I mean, Kemba's been doing this for a long time. He's been doing it on big stages for a long time. I mean, obviously, they're in the bubble. There's no fans. But Kemba Walker knows what's at stake here. He wants to beat Toronto. He wants more for his career. He's a guy that's been on a team that's underachieved for quite a while. I don't want to really say underachieved. That just really hasn't done well.
Yeah,
in Charlotte,
they didn't have the guys.
They didn't have the guys, exactly. So for Kemba, this is from the other side. You could say, as a Raptors writer, I'm genuinely glad for Kemba that he gets to experience this type of success with Boston.
Yeah, we didn't get that with Kyrie. We didn't get the good feelings from the other fan base around the league. Yeah, no. I've heard that from other teams, that this team's likable, that they actually do like seeing the Celtics team succeed, which hasn't always been the case from other fan bases. I want to run down these four guys quick before we finish this. Daniel Theis, you mentioned him. Incredible impact. Hitting the three against Marc Gasol here on this one. Gasol, he plays that drop defense, so Tice is going to get that. I think he was 2-for-15 in the playoffs coming in this one from three, but adds one in this game in the first half that helped. But I think the biggest impact he has on this series is stopping that Toronto fast break. You see him recover. He hits the three-point line when he gets back. Then when the guards slip up and they reset themselves defensively, he can drop down and recover and block a shot like he did here. He has four blocks in this series. He makes it so hard on Gasol to where Gasol, this two-time champion from last year, just looks incapable of playing here. So you've gone into Tice a bit, but can Marc Gasol, 9 fouls, just 13 points, only plus 6 in the series through game 2, can he play here as much as he has?
Yeah, that's a big storyline for Toronto. A lot of people are wondering, hey, is Marc Gasol the guy for the series? I mean, earlier before the series began, Raptors fans were kind of looking at Boston thinking, who's going to be the unplayable guy? And Enes Kanter really hasn't gotten the chance, yeah, you know, versus Toronto. And then you look at Toronto and it's like, Marc Gasol looks a step slow. He just looks like he's not rotating, you know, like he used to. He's not really hitting shots either. The size advantage isn't really helping him for Marc Gasol. He doesn't, his low post-up game has really eroded over the years. But with all that being said, I do not think Marc Gasol is unplayable. Just for what he does, you know, offensively, his IQ is off the charts. He can keep the ball moving. And I think with the defense as good as Boston's, Boston has a very specific trait that I think the Raptors share defensively, where they can kind of double team. And they, on defensively at least, they can find that open man before the offense can find him. And I think the Raptors and Celtics do that really well, where there's a guy open and Boston knows who that guy is, or Toronto on the other side knows who that guy is, and they'll find him before that, you know, so they can kind of double team and they can play 4-on-5 for a second. And then by the time you're swinging the ball around, you have Theis flying at you or Jaylen Brown flying at you for a contested jump shot. So I think for Marc Gasol's case, they need him for those type of reasons. You know, defensively, you just hope he can pick it up a little more. Game 2, we saw more of the Marc Gasol that we were used to, I think, defending the paint a lot better. Jaylen Brown is hitting some tough shots in there, even Jason Tatum at times. But I think Marc Gasol is definitely playable. I don't think it's time to kind of bench him. But with that being said, I do want to see a lot more Chris Boucher for Toronto.
Yep, not much of him. Another guy we haven't seen much of, 58% in that first round from three, Fred VanVleet, the upcoming free agent, got his family on the sideline, not helping much. I don't know where he's went in the series. He's taken deeper shots, especially that last one to try to tie the game. A few steps behind the line in transition, Tatum in front of him. This one here that we're showing, beginning of the first quarter, beginning of another rough game from three, 3-of-12 in this one. Siakam hits some clean out here. Tatum closes out in the end, and it's not close. It's off the back rim there. And he hasn't been close all series. I don't know. Is it just all that length for Boston that's throwing him off?
Yeah, with Fred, I mean, even going back to the last playoff run they had last season, Fred's just not a second-round guy. You know, like the Philadelphia 76ers, he shot, you know, terribly. And then obviously with Boston now, he's not really doing as well. He's not really carrying the momentum he had in that Brooklyn series. Overall, for the playoffs, you can look at Fred and you could say he's done a pretty good job for Toronto, because obviously you're taking the Brooklyn series into account. But against Boston, they need guys like Fred to really step up. They need guys like Pascal Siakam to step up. Kyle Lowry can only do so much. He is an all-star, but he also is 33 years old, and he's a guy that's going to have his off days and his on days in the playoffs. So for Fred, you know, most Raptors fans were kind of hoping that his child or his children actually being there would kind of help out, you know, give him that little extra voodoo, you know, that we were used to from the last playoffs. But I think with Fred, he struggled a lot. And a lot of that has, again, to do with Boston. I think Brad Stevens has done a good job trying to contain him. But yeah, I'll leave it at that.
Robert Williams, we got a hit on him. It took us this long. Wow, that putback. Unbelievable. It looked like he was almost at the free throw line jumping in on that one. Hurt himself there too. He was in and out through that first half, but that first quarter is where he gave him a massive boost. I think Boston was on the verge of going down by double digits in that first quarter. He comes in quick, about 6 minutes in for Theis, and gives him a new look. Doris Burke loves him. He's 10 for 10 in the series. I think Theis, we gave Theis his justice here because I think Theis is still the better option on that too. But Rob's the more explosive one. He's the more fun one to watch. You look at his numbers too, plus 36 per 100 when he did play this year, regular season, plus 25 in the playoffs. He's always a slight plus when you see him out there in terms of the game plus minus, plus six in the series. And he's got the jump shot that he flashed. Like he's in open on all his cuts. He makes mistakes too, which, you know, the Celtics people don't key in on that stuff as much. He had a bad turnover trying to throw it across the court. His positioning isn't always there, especially in transition. But Robert Williams, he gives you bench scoring. You think of him as a defender, shot blocker, all that stuff, but he scores a lot of points in a short amount of time too when he gets out there, and he's efficient. It doesn't get much more efficient than 10 for 10. My question to you, why is he always open? He's always open.
Oh, man. So, again, going into the series, you look at Boston as a team and you say, okay, top five talent, starters, this is probably one of the better teams in the league. Kemba Walker, just look at the top talent. I'm talking Marcus Smart, Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown. Their star power is there. For the Raptors and their fans, they weren't really sure, okay, who's going to be that guy that Boston kind of relies on? Who's going to be that guy? Is it going to be Wanamaker? Is it going to be Robert Williams? Who's it going to be? And I think Robert Williams has kind of played his role almost to perfection. He's not really forcing things. A lot of times you see with young players that when they do really well in a playoff setting, they want the ball back. And they want – Robert Williams is like, okay, you guys can handle the scoring. You guys, I'll take what I can take. I'll take the scoring that I can take. I'll play, you know, this very good defense in our system. Robert Williams has been a guy that, I mean, I'm shocked. I've never really watched this guy play. He's an athletic big. And
he hasn't been healthy a lot.
He's always hurt. Guy for Toronto, like, okay, like, what do we do now? Because if a guy like Robert Williams is doing really well, what exactly do we do? The Raptors have played a very good game, too, and they still lost that game. Robert Williams is 10 for 10 in the series. You back up, you take a step back, and you say, okay, what exactly can we do if Marc Gasol can't really guard this guy? If Marc Gasol looks like he's in quicksand when Robert Williams is coming off a screen and roll,
yeah,
what can they do? And Robert just has to keep taking what the Raptors are giving him.
Yeah, and it's tough. You can't follow a guy in midair when he's flying over your head, so that's not an option either, even though he's not the greatest free throw shooter. Like, when he slips off the screen, it feels like he's already in midair flying to the basket, and he can catch anything up there. It's a new dynamic, like you say, of the Celtics team, because they didn't have him for much of this year, didn't look great early in the bubble, and then out of nowhere, he's the top bench scorer. He was the leading scorer in the game through the first quarter, so just an unbelievable ascension to being pretty much their sixth man now that Hayward's gone, and a deadly one at that in this series with Kanter unable to play here. Let's get to Ibaka. They need more of him. They do. He's been awesome. He's always killed the Celtics. Game two, I look back on this stretch here where he's running in transition, leading a 10-0 run, almost got this to 12-0. He just missed another shot in transition inside. We speak of Robert Williams. Robert doesn't want to guard him at the three-point line, so he just shoots right over his head. And you know, 26 minutes isn't nothing, but I'd be playing this guy 30, 34, especially now down 0-2 in the series. Put your best guys out there. And, you know, you don't take Gasol completely, but maybe you put Ibaka into the starting lineup. Maybe you pump up his minutes and take some away from Gasol. You talk about Boucher, too. Ibaka's the guy who needs to be out there more than anybody, it feels like. They went with two bigs a little bit in game one when Siakam was in foul trouble. Game two, not so much. What do you do with Ibaka at this point with how well he's playing?
No, I totally agree with you. I think Ibaka is a guy that the Raptors need to rely on more. And for that, he needs to play more. For a guy like Ibaka, I mean, positionally and in height, you know, physicality, you would think he matches up pretty well with a guy like Daniel Theis, a guy like Robert Williams. He's not the type of guy like Gasol where he's going to get caught, like I said, in quicksand with Robert Williams, where Robert Williams just has an easy roll to the lane. Serge is a guy that can do almost everything the Raptors need him to do in this series. He can pop for you. He can roll for you. He's a guy that down low, he can post up a little bit, a very good rim protector. Serge Ibaka is a guy that definitely needs to play more. I think maybe you scale back Marcus Gasol to maybe the 15 to 20 minute range, and you give Ibaka maybe that extra whatever's left over, really. Maybe you toss a little bit of it to Chris Boucher, but I think Ibaka has to be the main big for Toronto. I think with Nick Nurse, he just thought coming into the series that Marc Gasol really naturally plays very well with a guy like Pascal Siakam. So he wants to give him every chance he can to kind of make his mark on this series. But now you're down 0-2. So it's like you have to do what's working for Toronto. You have to look at these last two games and say, okay, this is working, this isn't working. Let's stick to what's working and let's push what's working.
So how about the 2-0 in this series? We both picked the Raptors in 7. I don't know if it's going to get there. We'll see. Raptors need a big one in game 3. Subscribe to the channel. Watch the breakdowns as the playoffs go down. Bobby Manning, appreciate Sahal being here. If you're listening on the Dome Theory side, subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher. We'll have some of these week by week as the playoffs continue to roll. And it was great to meet Sahal here for the first time.
Thanks for having me on, Bobby. Really appreciate it.